I'm Justin Katz, and Last Impressions 28 is mostly about the consequences of government action we never see. So how's everybody doing? Did everybody survive the eclipse? You never know what might happen during these things. You know, it's funny, I've never been one to be overly impressed with the knowledge that I'm witnessing at some distance or at some remove a celestial occurrence. You know, I know they happen and they're very impressive. But when I was a boy, my mother would often get wind of something happening, some stars in a line or planets or whatever. And she'd get all excited and we'd go outside and look up and she'd say, "Oh yeah, see that dot? It's really close to that dot." And it just never quite resonated for me. And I felt something similar with the eclipse because, you know, you can't look directly at it, you know, unless you're in a totality for that 2 minutes or whatever it is. You have to have some kind of device, either a reflection in a box or special glasses, and if you have to look through something anyway, you know, it's more spectacular to watch it on TV, you know, or online, and at which point it doesn't matter if it happens right now. I mean, yeah, it was kind of nice. We were kind of neat. We were at an inflatable park out on the Cape. And, you know, it was kind of interesting to see it kind of just get a little darker. That was kind of interesting. More interesting was to watch all the other people there. And I was joining them at first till I figured it out. You know, you're trying to use their cell phones to take a picture and that kind of thing. But, you know, the camera doesn't appear to be able to pick up the difference between the full sun and the moon overlapping the sun. It's just, it can't pick up that contrast with a regular camera lens. And my wife said she heard somebody next to her, you know, took a picture with the cell phone camera and looked at it and said, "Oh yeah, that does look neat," but you couldn't see anything. I thought that was kind of funny. So, but 2024, this one, maybe I will try to get excited about. It's the total eclipse. Is within a reasonable driving distance up in northern New England. We'll be able to see it. That'll be fun. You know, once in a lifetime thing. I guess half the fun is making it fun, right? Convincing yourself that this is exciting and just creating a moment for yourself. That's half the fun, I think. But to get to the politics, I want to start on a relatively mild note. Secretary of State Nelly Gorbea was on Rhode Island Public Radio's political roundtable. And during the bonus Q&A that they put online, Ian Dunn has asked her about whether we have sufficient safeguards on mail ballots and that sort of thing to prevent fraud. And, you know, apart from denying that fraud is really an issue at all, I thought this was kind of an interesting take on Ms. Gorbea's part.
The best safeguards that we have on any election is having as many people vote who are legally and you know, able to vote. Large numbers prevent small numbers from controlling an election.
Sure, I guess. But more voters would dilute the fraud, sure, yeah. Unless, you know, the way we get more voters increases the opportunity for fraud. I mean, if to get more voters, we're going out there and we're saying you're automatically registered. So everybody will automatically be registered, even if they don't really care to vote. So fraudsters could maybe, you know, figure out who that is. And after a couple of election cycles of somebody not voting, say, "Hey, I'll go vote as that person." Also, other ways to get voter IDs and that sort of thing. It's really not that difficult. And a knowledge that, you know, if you're not necessarily going to be hunted down, they don't take your picture when you go vote. So if you go somewhere and vote illegally, and even if you're somewhat caught, are they going to do a nationwide manhunt for the vote fraud that never happens? You know, but if you expand the opportunity to fraud, if that's your way of getting more votes, you're not going to dilute the fraud. You're going to make it worse. So I have an alternative solution. You know, maybe we should stop making running for office more difficult. Stop requiring every candidate at every level to have a separate bank account and maybe a treasurer and fill out these forms that, believe me, people find onerous. It's just like if you're, I've said before with college tuition, if you have to pay something, even if it's not much, having to do that little bit will make you assess your priorities. So if you're not really interested in college, or you don't know where you're going to go yet, you might not spend $1,000 or whatever, even $100 for a college for a semester. But if you have to pay that, you'll consider it. So if you have to have these forms that you're going to fill out for the campaign finance and ethics and all that to run for office, you know, it's a price, it's a burden, and people might not do it. So maybe if we had more people running, we would have more people involved. That would be to not only because they're connected to the person and they know them, but because there are choices. So many of our elections in Rhode Island, there's simply no choice at all. For governor, the past few times we've had too many choices. That's a different problem. But in many of our legislative races and local races, there's just no choice. So why would people vote? So there you go. Make it easier to run for office. Make it less of an opportunity to trip people up in filling out forms. And hey, here's another one. How about term limits? Wow. You could get districts out of this, you know, one person for eternity rut. And then you've got multiple people. It becomes more interesting every couple of years. People know they can't, even if they want to vote in the same person, the same, hey, my guy's good kind of thing, then they know they have to go and vote because there's going to be somebody new, right? That might increase participation. Huh, maybe. Maybe it's just me and my cynical perspective on things in politics, but it seems to me that if you're trying to increase voters by making it easier to vote while restricting options, really, making it more difficult to be an option on the ballot, it starts to look a little bit like you're trying to manipulate the process a bit. I you know, as I said, it might just be me. Another interesting clip I heard this week came, I think it's actually a couple weeks old, but it's summer and somehow I didn't get any time to relax this summer. So except the park with the inflatable slides and stuff, I got to sit around and make sure the kids didn't crack their heads open, but which wasn't really relaxing. But and one interesting anecdote from a recent commentary podcast featuring mainly John Podhoretz talking, and this is him in a clip in a moment. They're talking about when you get government involved to take action and fix things, and he related an anecdote from a couple decades ago out of New York City, and I thought this is very, very much worth keeping in mind as Rhode Island discusses things like subsidizing a minor league baseball stadium.
So New York City, right? So New York City is healing itself in the 1990s, but it's, you know, it's an incredible turnaround. And there's this fallow neighborhood behind Penn Station. And Rudy Giuliani conceives of building a stadium there and doing this, building a platform over these open-air train yards. And I was then the editorial page of the New York Post. I supported it. All the editorial pages supported it on the grounds that the neighborhood in question was such a disaster that it could only be a good thing. And you know, basically use eminent domain to condemn some stuff, and the city helps pay for this platform. They put up a stadium, and it'll be transformative, right? So it turns out it didn't happen. Big fight over it, political fight. All the intelligentsia in New York supported it, and a lot of the politicians who just wanted to hand him a defeat or didn't like that he was spending so much money in Manhattan as opposed to the other boroughs prevented it from happening. And lo and behold, 20 years later, this neighborhood is now, there is $20 billion of private real estate investment that is building this entire neighborhood, and all the bad stuff is being torn down, and within 5 years, it's going to be, you know, the new kind of center of New York City. And had the centralized problem solving solution of the 1990s been put into place, it would have had a different fate and everything would have been different, but it would have been an unnecessary intrusion into what was a self-correcting market solution.
So it's very much like the idea of increasing voters to dilute fraud. You know, we need to fix actual problems. Prices, coughs, runny noses, unemployment, blight in your city. These are all symptoms. They're indications of some bigger problem. And now in a case of economic development, maybe it's not a problem that can be solved. Maybe your area just no longer fits the need in the world that it once did, and at which point people just have to exit until somebody finds a better use for that area and it adjusts. But we have to find those issues. What is it that's making this area not productive? And address those. There's no area that implicitly is not productive because there's no stadium there. It just doesn't work that way. If a stadium is the best use for that property, then the market will put the stadium there one way or another. It doesn't need government to interfere. But I thought this was a great example of having government not take action. And it worked out. And the problem we have in many ways nowadays is that government is doing so much that we don't know what would happen if it didn't get involved. And even when it doesn't and something good occurs, we hear all about how, oh, well, that got government research grants and the government paved the roads, you know, the whole you didn't build that thing. So there's this pitch that government is always behind everything, and it's just not true. Now, let me take a slight digression here to talk quickly about something that government does not keep going, and that's this podcast, this website, oceanstatecurrent.com. Now, if you've been a longtime reader of Ocean State Current or Anchor Rising before that even, you'll maybe notice how things change. You know, sometimes some people write more, some people write less. There's more content, less content. Sometimes it's quick posts just to have something on there. Sometimes it's stretches of longer research and news-breaking journalism. You know, it all depends on what else is going on in folks' lives, what else the Rhode Island Center for Freedom and Prosperity needs me to do. I can't spend a whole lot of time researching posts for the Ocean State Current when there's an important study I'm supposed to be doing. But we want to do more. Personally, I'd love to do much more of this. We'd love to find more contributors, more content, more journalism that breaks stories or advances stories rather than just sort of the blog presentation that I love. I love to read and I love to create, but essentially it's taking other people's content and putting it into a context, and the longer running narrative is essentially the new content. But to do any kind of expansion in that regard, we need support. We need people to help us out financially. There'll be a link. There's a link now on every post we do, but there'll be a link on this post if you want to contribute, or you can always contact us because we'll do pretty much anything, you know, within our principles. We'll want to advertise on the podcast, on the blog, on the site. That'd be fine. You want just donations? That's great. If you want to set up a dunking booth somewhere and have me sit there and get me all wet, hey, we can talk. I'm not saying I'll do it, but it's a possibility. More likely in the summer than in the winter, I would say. But we need your support because we're not government funded. Now, back to the content here. Another commentary podcast, and this was much more recent. Also, John Podhoretz talking, and he and his crew from Commentary Magazine were discussing the political violence that we've been seeing increase. And Podhoretz made an interesting, I want to say, observation about how counterintuitively political violence might be emerging as a bigger issue now.
All of this is the result of, you know, may in a weird way be the result of the fact that we have been living through a period of an unprecedented decrease in violence. Because when violence is a serious threat, it is cartoonish and offensive to pretend that, you know, to pretend that what you're going through is war and evil and criminal, because, you know, people are actually walking in the streets fearful for their lives. So if you create the conditions under which people are going to start walking in the streets fearful for their lives because they don't know if they're going to turn a corner and there's going to be like, somebody sucker punching them because they have a political button on that they don't like, or they have a bumper sticker on their car and someone's going to smash into their car because they don't like the bumper sticker. We are moving. This is a change for the United States.
So now this is one of those things I'd kind of like to do some baseline research before assenting to Podhoretz's thesis that political violence has increased a whole lot. But it is interesting to think of this contrast, because as we live in a safer and safer society, you would think people would become more used to safety and reasoned discussion. And maybe we are. He does have a point. I don't know the timeline exactly which came first, but sometime also within the past week, there was a story going around on the online news scene about a guy who was actually stabbed as he sat in his car because he had just gotten a haircut, and somebody thought his haircut looked like this neo-Nazi style, with the shaved side and the long top that flops over. And so somebody said, "Hey, is that a neo-Nazi haircut?" and stabbed at him. And the guy cut his hand because he blocked it from stabbing his head, blocked the knife from hitting his head. So there is that sort of vibe out there, that this is where we're getting, at the very least, political violence seems even more substantial because it's not in a context as much in just violence and danger in our ordinary lives. And I guess if I hadn't intended to go in this direction, so I didn't think it through very much. But if you look at, say, some of what might be termed political violence that didn't necessarily seem like it, like the riots in Baltimore, for example, after the police shooting, that has a different feel because these are somewhat more violent neighborhoods, whereas political violence coming to, just a quiet college community seems like a bigger contrast. And if the all of our societies were, all of our communities were more dangerous and more violent as once presumably they were, it would be less shocking that the violence of today happened to be political, whereas the violence of yesterday was something else. But I'm going to disagree, I guess, just a little bit with Podhoretz, because I don't know that it's that we don't have danger. Even if that's true, right? I think, and this may be an interacting thing where both things are true, but I think it's just harder to rev up comfortable people. It's harder to get people who are comfortable and feel safe and secure to go out and vote and become activists and storm the streets of Boston 40,000 strong to silence a free speech rally that has no Nazis in attendance, because, you know, we all want to go there, and Nazis are a danger to our society and the KKK, so we need to all gather around in Boston and march on them. So if you can rev up people, the activists can feed off that energy, donations and support and whatever else they want to accomplish, and sending messages to the other side, for example. But it's harder to do that when people are comfortable. And conversely, as we give government more and more authority over our lives, it becomes more and more important to get people revved up in order to put you in power so that you have control over this behemoth that now controls everything. I came across somewhat unrelated, but for that purpose, it's unique and interesting anecdote on Facebook recently in one Rhode Island community. A guy told the story of how he had been driving down a main road and he saw a young boy, two-ish, chasing a ball into the street. So the guy slammed on his brakes, stopped his car, left it right in the middle of the road, got out and got the boy and started bringing him toward the house that he had apparently come from. And he called out, "Hello, hello," a few times, and nobody answered. You can infer from his narrative that he started to walk around the back because he saw a group of 20 or so people there drinking, and he says he could smell the alcohol. And he came around a corner, and the boy's father came running over, made a nervous joke about needing to put his child on a leash. And so this person was on Facebook asking, "Should I call the cops? What am I supposed to do here?" And it was kind of disconcerting to watch people go from, you know, some suggesting call the Department of Children, Youth, and Families, DCYF, call the police, all the way up to people saying, "This family does not deserve their children," based on this somewhat sparsely detailed post on Facebook. I mean, some of the people on there presumably have no children themselves and maybe don't have experience understanding how quickly a child can just slip away. And it, you know, it sounds horrible when you're listening to somebody tell you how they, the boy came running out in the street and they stopped and called out and nobody was there. But then again, the post did say that the father came running over as soon as when he saw the boy with the other with this stranger. But and so we have the context gives us no indication of what the father had been doing. And for all we know, he noticed the boy missing almost the moment he was missing and just happened to run in the wrong direction initially looking for the kid. So you just don't know. And here are people saying they don't deserve their children. Call the police on these people. I piped up to suggest, you know, maybe not, you know, maybe the person putting the post up, if there were other indications, you know, if there were dangerous things sticking out of the ground and so that any parent ought to have been hovering over a child. But if it was just a family gathering in a safe yard and the person looked away for a moment, for all we know, you know, doing CPR on somebody. Yeah, that, I'm exaggerating. But the father looked away for a moment, the kid's gone. That's not necessarily an indication of abuse. There's just so much that was worrisome about the way this conversation carried on. For one thing, I got into arguments with some people there on the thread who were insistent that they think it was like I read a different post than they did. And I went back and I quoted the post. You know, this is what we know. The father, we don't know what the father was doing, but he ran up when he noticed the guy with his son. Maybe he was sitting there doing a keg stand. That would be one context. Or maybe he was running around looking for the kid, but we don't know. That's not in a text. And the person just said, well, I think we read a different post, you and I. Well, it's right there. You could go back and reread it, but they wouldn't. You know, that's disconcerting. And, you know, I couldn't help but think that that's what a liberal arts degree used to be supposed to do and to teach you, you know, rather than just indoctrination. But another disconcerting thing more broadly was the insistence of many people that it was important for the narrator, I guess you would call him, to go the guy who had saved the boy from traffic, which was a great thing to do. I want to make sure that's clear. But people encouraging him to go and report the incident to the local police and the DCYF to get it on the record, because you don't know if this was a single lapse or if this happens often. And if people aren't reporting them, then the authorities can't keep a running record of how many times this family has let the kid get loose. So we need to, people are saying, we need to get this incident on the record so the government can compile a list of our every lapse and misdeed and maybe take our children away. When did this happen? When did we decide that we need government to keep tabs on us, to be this long-running judge of our lives? Somebody pointed out, and it's true, that in Rhode Island, there's mandated reporting. So anybody in the state who reasonably could conclude that there might be evidence of some kind of child abuse, and it's very, very broadly written, is actually mandated to go and report it to DCYF. And DCYF is required to follow up within 24 hours. That's crazy. We're mandating that people, because they inform on their neighbors. I mean, when did this happen that we're mandated to report our neighbors if there's a hint of anything that could be construed to be abuse, for the purpose of getting it all on record so government has a file on everybody who's ever been seen to do something, not even bad, but maybe even just a little bit careless. And I think part of the problem is that we're offloading, in a sense, our moral responsibility. I mean, we report to government when we see something, and, you know, and this is very 1984, isn't it? Just kids informing on their parents. If you see something, say something. If they're not following Big Brother, you got to let them know. But if you report to government, then, you know, you did your part. You fulfilled your obligation. You'll never know if that child was, say, became one of the four who died in DCYF custody recently, or or the others, multiple more children who've been harmed in some way in group home incidents, or involving, you know, letting kids out, fights, that kind of thing. And, you know, even less if you report this incident and the child ends up in some, well, whatever happens as a result of your reporting, you'll never know whether that call created greater problems for the child than were solved by getting authorities. You don't know what bringing the police into the mix, knocking on a door, what effect that might have on people and their relationships. And people, some people said on this thread, and it's a common thing to say, if I had nothing to hide, I wouldn't mind them checking up on my child. Well, you know, that's very easy to say when someone else is the topic. It's very different, I would imagine, when your neighbors are the ones at their windows wondering why the police are at your house. That's not quite as comfortable as it may seem in the I've got nothing to hide. And, you know, if you are comfortable with that, it, in some sense, it might be a point of privilege. You don't have, say, an in-law who's always at your back about whatever. You don't have a neighbor who's always snooping and looking for some way to needle you about something that's happened, and the police showing up is just the right thing to do. Now, you know, obviously there are times we need to intervene, and not just individually like this man did, but involving authorities. But there's a threshold for that. But nobody was even considering the balance or finding the balance there. It was just do it. Just call the cops. And another detail that wasn't in the text that I think if people were more practiced at reading, they might have picked up on is the person telling the story didn't seem to know whether the kind of assumed, but didn't seem to know that whether the boy actually lived in the house or was one of the people just attending a party. So you can imagine what's being set in motion here. So he calls the cops. The cops show up at this house. Knock on a door. Maybe there are no children there. Now those people will, under the face of questioning, will maybe tell the cops, "Oh, well, that was this family from another town." So then those cops, I imagine, would have to call the police in the other town that the family actually lives in and get those police involved. And now they'll assess the situation at that house. And those police or somebody along the line will file with DCYF, and DCYF is obligated to follow up. And now you've got another government agency getting involved. It starts to be much more than a, hey, you know, send Gomer Pyle around to knock on a door and make sure everything's okay. Now that would be a different kind of a thing. At that moment, if there looks like there's an immediate threat, sending a police officer to check on things might be all right. Or if the threat looked more dangerous, as I said, dangerous implements around the house or something like that, then yeah, maybe it's worth having just an authority come in and check things out. But where's that line? I've recently posted on an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal is a guy who's lived in Sweden and at first was enamored of their government-funded paid time off for new parents. And then began to realize, you know, hey, that means I'm kind of like an employee of the government in raising my children, and they're the ones really in charge. And his in-law had a daughter who broke a leg, just, you know, as kids do. And the hospital, the doctor insisted on giving the kid an MRI, you know, radiation scanning, a full MRI to make sure that this broken leg wasn't an indication of running abuse. So they wanted a full body scan just to make sure, you know, hey, kid breaks a leg, that's an indication. So if we scan every kid who breaks a leg, we'll find the ones who are being abused. But the parents, I guess, said, no, we don't want to subject our child to that radiation, to that treatment, that trauma. So it's just a broken leg, we're going to decline. So they were reported and investigated, and people came into their house. The government agents, the Sweden's version of DCYF, whatever that is, came in, even to the point of inspecting what kind of milk they were serving the child. This is not a direction we should want to go in. We should be very wary, I think, of involving authorities in this way. Now, again, obviously, I'll say it over and over again, there's some point at which we should intervene, but we need to have a higher threshold and just understand that there are things we can resolve in appropriate degree without the government. You know, bringing that kid around the house and saying, hey, I almost ran your son over, should have been a wake-up call to that father, and probably was. Somebody else mentioned, not sure if it was the same anecdote or another one recently, that the family, there was a family with a similar situation. It was a wake-up call. They put up a fence. So you don't know. And as neighbors, if you're really concerned, you know, maybe go back. If you see the kid out in the front again, then it's, in, you know, up your concern. We can't always be trying to eliminate every possibility, because nothing is entirely safe. As we saw, if kids are dying in DCYF's care, you're not making that imperfectly safe. Who's to say that the odds of not disrupting this family are make it more dangerous, or have higher odds of being dangerous and deadly than involving them in some other situation? We don't know, and we can't just offload our moral responsibility. And above all that, we have to keep a very careful eye on all of these trends. So just look at this podcast. We've got government proclaiming it can solve problems that it can't with voter fraud, and sometimes very likely accomplishing the opposite, making the problems worse. We've got government increasingly stepping in to solve problems that the private sector, and that includes not just businesses, the private sector businesses, but also all of society, all of us acting together outside of the aegis of government. We can solve these problems probably better and don't need government to intervene, because government isn't going to solve the underlying problems, but just some kind of some of the symptoms. We've got an increase in political violence, partly because political power is increasingly valuable and far-reaching. And then we've got an attitude that we need government to keep tabs on our neighbors so that the authorities, can create a better picture of just how bad we all are and keep us in line. We're in a dangerous situation if that's where we're going. And you know, this volcano can blow, and I don't think we're going to like where we land when it does.